On the bench and behind the scenes, it's heating up on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Will there be an extreme injustice? In a closely divided North Carolina, America's ninth largest state, politics has taken a dangerous turn, moving from the campaign trail to the court bench. Little known to the public, four state Supreme Court justices are considering a legal maneuver that threatens the credibility and viability of the state's highest court for decades to come. Two constitutional amendments, 9.6 million votes, and the fate of two duly elected Supreme Court justices hang in the balance. The Wall Street Journal calls it scorched earth judging, writing that if successful, this institutional mischief will reverberate far beyond North Carolina. How did we get here? And where are we going? And will raw partisan politics alter the courts for generations, throwing our constitutional order into chaos? Reported by the Carolina Journal and produced by the John Locke Foundation, I am your host, Dallas Woodhouse, and this is Extreme Injustice. Welcome back, everybody, to Extreme Injustice. I'm Dallas Woodhouse with my adult supervision, Mitch Kokai. Mitch, since we recorded our last podcast, lots has been happening. We have lots to catch up everybody on, but I think this is the most important. When we broke this story, now listen, if you are just picking up this podcast, you need to go back to episode number one and listen from the beginning. Visit extremeinjustice.com, get up all the details and the information, get yourself caught up. It'll make a lot more sense to you because we're picking up the story somewhat in the middle. When we first broke this story, and I'm going to put you on the spot, Mitch. You know, I write this article and I come out and I say they are thinking about recusing these justices, throwing two justices off of a case to help overturn two constitutional amendments. When you first read it, even before we published it, what did you think?
I thought maybe, because it was plausible, but there were also some certain other possibilities that were happening. We didn't really know exactly why the state Supreme Court had decided to put off this case about the two constitutional amendments. The ideas that were in your story look like, you know, this could be true, but maybe something else has happened and we just don't know. But now, as you're about to tell us, we know that what you originally discussed is something that really is under consideration.
Right. I think that's probably a very nice way of saying it, because I think when most people read it, they went, what? This can't happen. There is no way the court is this crazy. This would be destructive. This would be dangerous. And I ran into a lot of that. I ran into a lot of that with people who've known my work at the party. I think people who generally regard my work as solid. The critics, of course, bashed it, but we would have expected that. But then, you know, just about a month after we broke that story and wrote about it, the court did something very interesting. And it was an order that came out from the court. Now, we're going to spend some time talking about this, and it's somewhat unusual because what we really have is an internal debate among the Supreme Court. But in this case, they sent out an order requesting that the attorneys representing the NAACP, of course, the case over the amendments is NAACP versus Tim Moore, and the attorneys that are representing the legislative defendants or the state of North Carolina, to sort of argue this idea of forced recusals.
Now, maybe we should back up just a little bit and remind people that the way that this came to light was this case over the two constitutional amendments and whether they could be put on the ballot or not was a case that was in front of the state Supreme Court. It was on their calendar for oral arguments, and then all of a sudden it disappeared. And right. there was no word from the court about why. But if you look back in the court record, you saw that a couple months beforehand, there had been this motion from the NAACP to remove the two justices. Shortly after that motion, there was a response from the lawyers working for the legislative defendants saying why you shouldn't have those justices removed. But then silence. There was nothing else in the record. And so when you came out with your initial article, basically, a lot of this was, why did this happen? Why was this case that was supposed to be on for oral arguments, why was it taken off? And then you came up with your story that suggested here's what's happening behind the scenes. And then the order showed that what you had been reporting was actually what was happening behind the scenes.
That's right. So just a quick recap. The NAACP has said that the legislature itself was unconstitutional in 2018 when they put the amendments on the ballot because they came out of constitutionally questionable districts. The court at the time declined to block the amendments from going on the ballot, but the NAACP sued after. It sued after the amendments had passed. A lower court came up with a ruling and said that the legislature was illegitimate. These two amendments shouldn't count. Again, it's the amendments on voter ID and lowering of the maximum allowable income tax rate in North Carolina. The appeals court overturned that. We were headed for the Supreme Court. That is when the NAACP makes the motion to have Justice Berger, Justice Berenger, two newly elected GOP members, forcibly removed from the case. Berger Jr. because his dad's in the legislature, Tamara because she, or Justice Berenger because she had been in the legislature when the amendments were passed. So we had this sort of issue out there, and a lot of people questioned our work, and then the court sent out an order issued by Anita Earls, who is the well-known, most liberal member of the court, an activist member, and we're going to have more on her in coming episodes. And they asked some fascinating questions that I think brings a lot of this to light. You know, they ask about seven questions, and we're going to go through some of them here. What historical and current recusal practices are utilized by state and federal courts of last resorts in the United States? Now, I'm going to stop there. It's important to know that the Supreme Court is a court of last resort. If you remove a trial judge because he has some kind of conflict, you can replace them with somebody else. You can't do that on a Supreme Court. To the extent that another state's court of last resort has rules allowing the involuntary removal of justices or recusal of justices, who does not believe that they should be removed, upon what authority are those rules predicated? And what process was used to adopt them? Does the recusal process differ in a state and federal courts of last resort? And if so, why? What did that tell you?
Yeah, and that was just question number one. We're talking about eight questions. This tells me, first of all, that this is under consideration. We certainly know that some members of the Supreme Court are considering this. I find it interesting you mentioned that Justice Earls was the one who wrote this order. Typically, the procedure for the Supreme Court is if an order comes out from the court, it's not an opinion, but just an order. Usually the most junior justice writes that order. But in this case, it was not either Berger or Berenger who would be the junior most justice. It was Anita Earls, which just suggests to me that Berenger and Berger are not signing off on this.
Yeah. The second question was, does the court have the authority to require involuntary recusals of a justice who does not believe that self-recusal is appropriate? That is the baseline of what we are talking about. And if so, what legal principle does that authority rest? What role do the statutes play? What role do the provisions of judicial conduct play in making any such recusal decisions? We do have a section of the courts. It's known as the
Judicial Standards Commission,
which normally deals with complaints on justices, but they also can give private advice to judges about whether they have some kind of conflict. I have theorized that I bet these judges have been cleared by Judicial Standards in a private opinion. I don't know that for sure, but as you can see, we're dealing with uncharted territory. That something hasn't happened in 200 and some years in North Carolina. Again, does the court have the authority and the power to force its colleagues who are duly elected off of the court? Now, here's an interesting question that the court posed to these lawyers. Are there any differences in the principles to be utilized in determining whether a justice of a court of last resort should be recused and those governing the recusal of a judicial official serving as a member of a trial court or lower appellate court.
Yeah, you've already alluded to this. Right. This is the fact that a court of a last resort is in a different situation. Those lower courts, you can replace a judge in the case of a court of last resort. Harder to do, if not impossible.
Right. And I think what this is also showing to you is not only is this uncharted territory, that if the Democrats did this, they'd be making it up as they went along. There is no process. There is no procedure. There is no precedent for it. And, of course, before we take a break, I want to talk briefly about question five. And I will summarize this. And I have to give you credit, Mitch. You were the one that first brought up this to me, and I hadn't thought about it. It was the question of if this motion to recuse the two justices is put in front of the court, which it likely is going to be, do the two justices that are possibly being forced off... Do they get a vote then? In other words, are you legal bootstrapping? You know, in other words, not only could you not participate in the case, you can't even participate in the motion that decides whether you can participate on the case. I think this is one of the fascinating questions the court asked.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you've already talked some in the podcast about the politics of this, but this has an important role in the politics, because if, as has been theorized, one of the reasons for removing these two justices is to allow one of the Democratic justices to vote in favor of keeping voter ID and the tax cap, that same justice would be able to do the same thing on this vote and say, oh, no, I don't think we should remove our two colleagues, and vote along with Chief Justice Paul Newby on that front, and then not have to cast any vote that's going to come back to haunt him.
Yeah. So that would be Justice Jimmy Ervin, who is, of course, up for election in 2022. The premise of our original article and all along has been that they wanted to protect Jimmy Ervin politically going into the 2022 elections, while figuring a way to, eliminate these two amendments. Now, I have said that I think that this is why judges often don't make very good political candidates, and they make horrible political strategists, because I think this would doom Jimmy Ervin anyway. He would have been a part of this no matter how he votes. And I think the Democrats would pay a price for that, but that is still to be determined. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some more of these questions and what they mean for the future of the judiciary on this broadcast, this podcast of Extreme Injustice.
Extreme Injustice, an investigative project of Carolina Journal, is produced by the John Locke Foundation. For three decades, Locke has served as an independent, nonprofit think tank that works for truth, freedom, and the future of North Carolina. Locke envisions a strong North Carolina committed to individual freedom, personal responsibility, and limited constitutional government. To support our work, please visit johnlocke.org. Carolina Journal is your source for news and commentary covering politics and public policy. As a project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of taxpayer funds by public officials, including members of Congress and the state legislature. Now, our attention is squarely focused on the North Carolina Supreme Court with our in-depth investigative series, Extreme Injustice. Visit CarolinaJournal.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Extreme Injustice. Now, in one of the first questions that was presented by Anita Earls on behalf of the courts to the attorneys in this case, she asks a very fascinating question is asked. What enforcement mechanism exists to ensure compliance with any such recusal decisions? Now, if you think about it, the court doesn't have an army. It does have court marshals. But for the most part in our system, the court's word and its stature are responsible for its enforcement. We expect the legislative branch and the executive branch to follow the wisdom of the court, to respect its rulings. But here, it's a fascinating question. It is, how do you enforce involuntary recusals on the other justices?
Yeah, in fact, when you have been discussing this, I know on a couple of occasions I've heard you ask, well, what's going to happen if Justice Berger and Justice Barringer just decide to show up and sit down? Will someone else say, you know, bailiff or marshal, remove this person, and who would do it?
Yeah, are they gonna send Berger and Barringer to Guantanamo Bay? I mean, I have a feeling the Republicans had a hand in crafting these questions, because it brings out some fascinating issues of, now if you do this, you're opening up one big mega can of worms that are going to have to be dealt with, and the enforcement part of this. Another one of the questions put in front of the court is, does an elected justice have an individual constitutional right to participate in deciding every case that comes before the court? So I think this raises the possibility that if they were to remove these justices, we could be headed to federal court. Do these judges have a constitutional right once they were elected under a state constitution to participate? That is actually an argument we're going to talk about in a future episode presented by some very prominent attorneys in North Carolina. You know, other questions are about, you know, what written rules should be adopted to govern the recusal.
And if so, who drafts them and keeps them?
Yeah. You know, another question is, you know, should there be a finding of fact? In other words, you know, Justice Barringer and Justice Berger have clearly stated behind the scenes that they don't believe they have a conflict, a reason to recuse. Traditionally, that has been what we have gone with, that is the judges themselves decide whether they have a conflict. And if you are saying they do have a conflict, or they have the appearance of a conflict, you know, does there need to be some process for establishing a set of facts to that? And I suspect that that is not something the Democrats on the court want to get into.
And, you know, this is something that, regardless of what happens in this particular case, if you're going to go down this road where there's going to be, for the very first time, some sort of involuntary recusal or disqualification, you would think there's got to be some sort of record as to why. If not, in the future, a Supreme Court led by Democrats, led by Republicans, led by whoever could decide, you know, we don't like our two colleagues on the end of the bench. We're just going to disqualify them. And if there's no record as to why, that's definitely going behind and against what the people who voted to put that person on the bench wanted.
Yeah, I think that's always been the danger, is that, you know, as we have said, as I said in the very first article, we elect the Supreme Court to decide cases, not to decide who sits on the Supreme Court. The voters do that. I think when you take the order as a whole, Mitch, you see that kind of a warning shot to the court, one of many that we'll discuss, and that if you go down this road, you know, with no rules in place, no history of this, you know, and quite frankly, precedent to the contrary, you know, I mean, many justices have been on the state Supreme Court that were recent former legislators. I mean, that's probably the number one place that Supreme Court justices come from. You know, the idea of Phil Berger Jr. being the son of the president pro tem is a little unique, but it's not wholly unique. We've had a member of the legislature whose wife was on the court. On the appeals court, we've had other instances, and those have not been reasons to recuse in the past. And what you are really talking about is a fundamental reordering of how we, change what judicial elections mean, change the trust we put in our justices. We are allowing some other group of people to decide for judges that the voters have installed on the court and with confidence to rule that their judgment ought to be questioned, not in their rulings, which of course it is completely appropriate to question their rulings. We do so quite often, but to question their integrity about hearing a case.
And I think these questions also suggest that if the court does not take all of these factors into account, that it's just being done on the fly. I mean, a lot of these major changes in the court system would be done through an open, deliberative process, even more so than the legislature. When you have a major change in the court system, it is tended to be something that's You set up a blue ribbon commission. They spend months and months talking about it. They go back and forth, come up with a report, and then someone may do something about the report, or they may file it away on a shelf and it goes away. In this case, it looks as if before this order came out, all of the discussion was, hey, do we boot these two justices off? And these questions suggest that if that process is going to take place, there needs to be a lot of thought about how you would do it and do it in an appropriate way, if it can be done in an appropriate way.
Coming up in our next episode, we're going to talk about some of the very powerful voices that are on both sides of the aisle that are raising concern about this. But I do want to speak to you about one thing that has amazed me in this whole process, is that, you know, the Democrats on the Supreme Court have obviously considered this. There's serious consideration about it. There is still serious consideration about it today.
And the reason we're talking about the Democrats having consideration of this, to remind people, we have a 7-member court. 4 of them are Democrats, so they have a majority. If this were just 2 people on a 7-member court, it wouldn't be a problem. The Democrats hold a 4-3 majority, and if they succeed in this case of getting Berenger and Berger removed, they would have a temporary 4-1 majority on this case.
Right. And of course, they have already moved. The NAACP has already moved to have Phil Berger Jr. removed off a case dealing with felon voting rights. I laugh about that one because that's the one where law in question was written in the early 1970s when Justice Phil Berger was in diapers, and Senator Phil Berger was still working in a press mill in Virginia and wouldn't enter the legislature for another 30 years. But one of the things that's always amazed me is the Democrats considering this nuclear option for something that doesn't seem to gain in a lot. I mean, the statewide income tax right now is, 3.99%?
It could go down. There's 5.25% right now.
Yeah, if the Democrats took over the legislature tomorrow, it would be years before they could raise the tax rate up to 7%. I mean, or beyond 7%. We've raised taxes when they've done it in quarter points and half points. And the question about a constitutional amendment over voter ID is really moot today. You know, the Republicans are not going to have voter ID in place until they pass a new statute, a new law about it. And they're going to have a supermajority to do that, which they don't. And they're going to have a Republican Supreme Court majority to uphold it, which they don't. So it's amazing to me that they've even considered these kind of, just nuclear steps over something that doesn't seem to gain them a lot anyway in the long run.
Certainly true. And I think a lot of legal observers, when they saw this initial motion back in July from the NAACP, didn't pay a whole lot of attention
Nobody
to
it. Nobody took it serious.
Because everyone thought, okay, well, they're throwing something against the wall. They're trying to see if they can get some help for their case. But as you said, no one really took it seriously. It only got serious attention once, at the very last minute, this case disappeared from the court's calendar.
All right. We're going to wrap it up here today. Thank you, Mitch. Mitch is the adult supervision. He keeps me straight. Please give us a positive rating on the podcast. We'd like to hear from you. You can contact me on Twitter, @DallasWoodhouse. You can visit carolinajournal.com, but make sure you're visiting extremeinjustice.com. Send that link out to your friends. Tell everybody about this podcast. We're going to stay on this for months, if not through the next year, into the judicial elections, and talk about all the different effects things that are happening on the court could affect the people of North Carolina and could eventually affect people in other states. So make sure to give us a positive rating. Let us hear what you like, what you don't like. We'd love to hear your feedback. For Carolina Journal, I am political investigative analyst Dallas Woodhouse, and this is Extreme Injustice. Extreme Injustice is an investigative project of the Carolina Journal and produced by the John Locke Foundation. It is written and hosted by me, Dallas Woodhouse, with adult supervision from our senior political analyst, Mitch Kokai. Creative design by Greg D. Doug, with communication support from Brooke Medina. Donna King is the editor-in-chief of the Carolina Journal. Donald Bryson is the president of the John Locke Foundation, and Amy Cook is the publisher and CEO. For this story's latest development, please visit carolinajournal.com and extremeinjustice.com. Follow us on Twitter at Carolina Journal. To support this and other work of the John Locke Foundation, please visit johnlocke.org as we continue to expose extreme injustice.